Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi there, Simon here. We are taking a week off before we get you back to our regularly scheduled programming. Let me ask you a question, though. Are you excited for the French Open year? If Rome didn't whet your appetite, then hopefully this look down memory lane will get you in the mood for Roland Garros in just a few short weeks. I'm an unashamed Justine Henin stan, but I'll be the first to admit that this match has its fair share of issues. It's spicy, it's high stakes, it's got everything you'd want in an open-era rewind. Enjoy it, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hello and welcome to the Open Era Podcast. My name is Devang Desai, and I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Simon Bushel. Bush, the listeners need to be updated on your exploits with our boy Luke, our Discord chat friend Luke, playing on the courts in Vancouver. How's it going, Bush?
Not too bad. It was a good first hit for a while. I hit with my girlfriend a few nights ago, and that was also an interesting experience. Rusty, I think, is probably the right phrasing for it, but I had a hit with Roger Federer's autograph racket, so the RF97 autograph, which I'd never hit with before. And it's basically, it's almost a carbon copy of the one that he actually uses on tour. And it's really interesting to get to swing a racket that a professional would use. My shoulder was very close to falling off by the end of the hour that I was hitting with. And I thought my entire body was going to fall apart.
So it's just extremely heavy.
It's about, roughly when it's strung, it's about 370 grams. So I think most of us probably swing a racket that's about 300. So it's probably quite a bit heavier than what we're used to.
It's interesting. I'm waiting for my Tech 5 racket to come in the mail, but I'm super excited to go out for a hit. I didn't play much last summer, but when I did, I'm not saying the racket was the biggest thing, but I was using a very old one that I think undersold my abilities. So basically what I am saying is it is all in the racket and I will be a superstar soon.
Well, I think if it takes into account what I was playing on Roger Federer's racket, I was playing like Roger Federer. So it kind of goes hand in hand at this point.
You remember the racket I used in Vancouver was a Diadora racket, which as a shoemaker and a bicycle maker even, sure, but tennis, I did not know they were involved, and the racket spoke for itself, but we'll move on.
Moving on swiftly.
Simon, this is your pick. Let the listeners know, let me know again, but why are we looking back on a semifinal for the French Open, though I must admit, what a match.
Well, I think it's a really interesting one to look back at. When you look at the history of the French Open, and especially on the women's side, there are good rivalries through the course of the tournament's history. But I think one stuck out to me in particular, and that's Serena Williams versus Justine Henin from 2003, not simply because you had so many storylines sort of all coming into the tournament at the same time. You had an up-and-comer in Justine Henin who was on the verge of superstardom right at the start of her career, and Serena Williams, who was just 21 years of age herself, but was on the back of a 33-match winning streak, and basically she won everything that she entered. So this one lives in infamy for a number of reasons. It's got a lot of controversy in it, and the quality of tennis is exceptionally high. And I think we're all in a period of time where we're looking back in a lot of ways at some historical sporting events, and none more fitting than to look back at a truly epic semifinal between two all-time greats.
Roger and Rafa have the grand sum of zero grand slams at this point, and Serena Williams is basically winning everything she enters. She is the best player in the world, full stop. Like, this is Pete's end, and the Graf era is pretty much done. Monica Seles is in this tournament, but she loses in the first round for the first time in her career at a grand slam. This really is the Williams sisters' time, and more specifically Serena Bush. 33 Grand Slam matches won in a row. That is ridiculous.
Well, we've talked about Serena, I think, on this podcast for a decent chunk, but I think sometimes we tend to forget the exploits at the start of her career, just how good she was at a very young age. And I know young is kind of put in strange terms on the women's side, because we recently were talking about Martina Hingis winning a Grand Slam at 16, but this is still a very young woman at this period of time. 20 years of age, she wins three Grand Slams in the year in 2002. Coming into 2003, I mentioned that 33-match winning streak at Grand Slam level. It's astonishing, really. She loses to Venus in the final of the US Open in 2001. From that point onwards, it's just a straight massacre. She just tortures every single tournament that she plays in. And honestly, we sit here in 2020 and we know what kind of career that she had, but at this point in time, there were people saying that she might never lose a match during another year. And it was kind of crazy to look back at it.
Yeah. And not hyperbole. I think you could argue that it was not the craziest thing you heard. It was absolutely ridiculous. And I think it's interesting. You watch Henin's rise at a similar juncture where semifinals, she made the final at Wimbledon in 2001. But this is someone also, Bush, who you mentioned, who showed that she could play on the bigger stages and wasn't necessarily afraid of confrontation. And I think you can say that this match was defined by confrontation, specifically in the third set. You don't get a moniker like the hand match, quote unquote, without having some pretty unique things go down. But it really was a fun match to look back on. And I was watching the 2010 Australian Open final between Henin and Williams a few weeks ago, and it's funny, a lot has changed. There's many years that went in between, 7 years, but Serena is wearing the same color scheme as her dress that she's wearing in 2003, and a lot of the same qualities from both players were there in 2010, but they were there in 2003. They were just younger and better moving at that point, so you can imagine how good a match that sets up for.
Well, I think one of the interesting things as well, looking at these two in particular, and talking specifically about Serena in relation to that, is what are Serena's rivalries? And I think we know so much about the big three on the men's side that we have such epic rivalries between three players. Serena's side and her era, she kind of stretches across three decades almost. Yeah, almost three decades in terms of winning Grand Slams. It will be three decades, I'm sure, at some point. But you think about it from a certain standpoint, obviously her sister, very early on in her career, and I think she kind of owns that record from when she loses in that final in 2001. I think Venus is much more of a powerhouse player early on in her career, and I think Serena is still a little bit in awe of her in some ways before she fully becomes her own Grand Slam champion. You could argue Jennifer Capriati, you could argue Lindsay Davenport, but I think those rivalries, I think they sort of pale in significance in certain ways. I would argue that Justine Henin is a main rival, and it's just the fact in so many ways that Henin was out through injury, or, I mentioned the fact that she has a body like a wasp. I think it's true, and I don't mean to be disrespectful at all, but her body broke down on her so many times. I think we were robbed of so many more matches at Grand Slam level, and I think it's a shame in so many ways, because I think it could have been an all-time great rivalry.
Serena's head-to-heads are hilarious. Like, she's 18-4 against Azarenka, but all four of those Azarenka wins came in finals. Like, what a bizarre thing to see, but overall, she was 10-7 against Capriati, very close with Hingis. She led that 7-6. She leads Venus 18-12. But you're right, Henin, Serena was 8-6 against her. But I felt like some of her biggest losses in her career came against Henin in pretty big moments. And we've covered Justine before, that Clijsters match. She would face Kim Clijsters again in this French Open. But it's fun to look back on. Man, what I found myself doing a lot during this match was just looking at Henin's feet during points. And I know we know all about the backhand, and we know all about the power she can generate from such a small frame. But I think the reason she generated such power so consistently was how well she damn moved. It was crazy.
And it gets shown up so well on a clay court. She just moves impeccably on a surface that demands incredible movement as well. And I think if you look at throughout the course of her career, and especially at her Grand Slam record, it is shocking going into 2003 that she lost in the first round. It's not very often that you see someone losing in round one at a Grand Slam the year previously and then going on to having such incredible success and running deep in tournaments to get to the semifinals and get to finals after being knocked out at the very preliminary stages of a tournament. It's pretty shocking, but it goes to show. I mean, she was still very, very young at this point. I believe she was 19 the year she got knocked out in the first round, and she's 20 going into this tournament. So still very, very young. Let's, you know, we always talk about that in the capacity that Serena Williams is 21 here and has won, I think, 7 Grand Slams at this point. So
that's not normal. That's not normal. It's crazy. Just to zoom out a bit on at the 2003 French Open as a whole, you had 5 Americans in the top 10. Monica Seles, her last tournament, as I mentioned, she was a 12 seed, lost to Nadia Petrova, Lisa Raymond, Megan Shaughnessy, Alexandra Stevenson, Laura Granville. Very deep American presence, which you still see today, but it was a little top heavier in 2003, where you had 4 or 5 people that could legitimately win this title. Then, of course, the Belgian duo of Clijsters and Hannen Hardin, who made so many important finals during this run as well. But she mentioned this, like, Graf is ending, Seles is ending, the Williams sisters are playing all these people, Lindsay Davenport, so you can argue in the prime of her career. They really did play everyone, the Williams sisters. It's wild. They, for many reasons, I hope Serena gets that another slam that she can do this decade run, but it's just remarkable to go back and look through the names of the people she played, and just looking at this draw, there's a bunch of them right here. Patty Schnieder, legend.
It would take you to bring up Patty Schnieder. I think it's very funny. 32nd seed, Francesca Schiavone as well.
Right.
Former Grand Slam champion. No, I think you're right in pointing out just how dominant in a lot of ways they've been across multiple eras. I mentioned that we're going to see 3 decades, basically, of the Williams sisters. I believe Venus and Serena both hit that, right? They both played in 3 decades at Grand Slam level at the start of this year in Australia. Which is astonishing. I mean, it really is amazing just the longevity they've had and the victories they've had across that entire period. I mean, it baffles the mind really in so many ways. Not least the fact that we were talking about Pete Sampras retiring at 33 or whatever it was, 32, and Steffi Graf retiring at 30. And then you have Serena Williams, who's going to go on and probably be playing in 2021, 22, and is going to be almost 40 years of age. It really is remarkable. But I think you're right, touching on particular this tournament, looking at the seeds and looking at the players that are in this, it's a really stacked field. There's players who go on to have excellent careers, who are multiple Grand Slam winners, who are really like tough outs, and regardless of what point in the career they're at. And we really do get a good feast of players at the latter stages of this tournament.
On the men's side, I guess we can call this the dark period, Bush, or AD, or before life. I don't know. My Bible references are not good, and I definitely angered someone by that. But Martin Verkerk versus Juan Carlos Ferrero in the final. Good Lord, Martin Verkerk. I think I washed that from my mind. But yeah, he made the final here.
Wow. I do remember this match. I watched this final. I watched Ferrero versus Verkerk, and there was lots of chat around that period of time that Juan Carlos Ferrero was going to be one of the greatest clay court players ever to play. You look at his 2003
year. The NBC broadcast.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you do. You look at 2003 and you look at 2004 and 2002, and you have Guillermo Coria. You have Juan Carlos Ferrero. You have players who, at the time, these were pinnacle people on clay courts. They were astonishingly good. The records they have were truly amazing. And then Rafael Nadal came along. And it's crazy how he just crushed everyone in his path when you look at this period of time and you have someone who really, like, Juan Carlos Ferrero was world number one. He won a Grand Slam. He got to finals. He had a really great career, honestly, but he's kind of forgotten in the grand scheme of things.
And I don't want to sell Martin Verkerk short. He took out Carlos Moya in 5 sets, then beat Coria in straight sets, and then got wiped in the final. But that's an insane run for an unseeded player. Another blast from the past looking at this draw, and it reminds me that we definitely have to cover Guga Quirin in somewhere form soon.
All right. I think I'd like to cover a Juan Carlos Ferrero match at some point as well, because it would be entertaining to go back and we could talk about it.
Steve Tignor before the match, or not before the match, but in a look back, talking about Williams versus Hannon. Serena perhaps recognizing a future rival when she saw one, the same way Steffi Graf had recognized a future in Monica Seles on the same court more than a decade earlier, rose to Hannon's challenge. Bush, before we get on to the match on the other side of the break, we've talked about Hannon before and we've talked about Serena a lot, but I kind of wanted to focus in on Serena at this point. We've watched her for how many years now? You meant like something wild, 20 years, 20 plus years, 23 or so years. And the evolution of her game is obviously fascinating to see because you see someone at the top of their game. But 2003 Serena, I don't know if it was talked about at the time at this level, but the backhand to me possibly was on the same level of the forehand in terms of what she could use as a weapon against someone like Hannon, who was using her backhand for fun.
There's some very funny shots in this match where you would think that Serena's coming in from a short ball and she's taking a forehand. There are some very just like genuinely fascinating points where she comes in and instead of hitting a forehand, she rips a backhand instead. She's running around on the backhand side. That's how much, just how much confidence she had in that stroke at that period of time. And I think in a lot of ways, it is the stroke that has broken down for her a lot over the last sort of few years. And I was reading an article recently that was talking about how she had dropped the swing weight of her racket a little bit over in a bid to get to this final Grand Slam that she so desires. And I think that's interesting. I think she's recognized in a lot of ways that her game needs to evolve to get to that point, which is crazy considering how many Grand Slam finals she's been in recently and how close she's been. But I don't think we talk about her in the same way that we talk about some other players who have had to evolve in their career. She kind of has had one speed throughout her entire career. She's such an impeccable ball striker. She has such a great mind and such a great all-court game that honestly, she's just been great her entire career. And it's reductive. I understand that to kind of put it in those terms, but she's just been so good that she hasn't really had to evolve until recently. She's kind of pushed everyone off the court that she's played against.
Yeah, we talked about Serena after the US Open final against Bianca and going to that toolbox and not necessarily finding the things that she needed. She had all that stuff in 2003 and more stuff. She probably had enough for two toolboxes, but that makes it even more impressive what Justine Hannon was able to pull off that day in Paris. So when we come back after the break, it's the 2003 French Open semifinal between Serena Williams and Justine Hannon.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to the Open Era Podcast. Simon, the first set is underway between Justine Hannon and Serena Williams in the French Open semifinal. A date with Kim Clijsters in the final awaits. From the get-go, Bush, both players looking really good, but Justine Hannon looks just a bit better.
Definitely, yeah. And you can hear the hometown crowd. It's not quite a hometown, but it's very close to it. Belgium to Paris, it's really not far at all. And the crowd will become a central part of this match, as we will hear, I'm sure, throughout the three sets that this one runs to. Hennen's ball striking is phenomenal. Her footwork's incredible. And really, coming into this match, Serena is the overwhelming favorite. Really, really the overwhelming favorite. We mentioned the 33 match wins in a row. And I mentioned the fact that you find articles around that period of time where people thought that she was genuinely unbeatable at Grand Slam level, which really gave this a properly big fight atmosphere. It really felt like someone who could match Serena in terms of power, but also just in terms of craft and all the things necessary to try and win this match. And Ennen jumps on her really, really out the gate. She jumps all over the serve and she finds her rhythm really early. And Serena looks a little rattled, it has to be said, through the first few games of this match.
I think we're fully into the period of time where people were cheering against Serena Williams. Not everyone, obviously, but in this crowd, it felt like a lot of them. And some of them were for the reasons you mentioned, Bush, because Justine Henin's from Belgium, and obviously it's very close to France. But we got into that territory where like Serena was better than everyone else. She was winning everything. And then the obviously sordid and terrible aspect of racists or bigots or people who were just genuinely jerks and assholes who didn't like Serena Williams and made it known in very loud ways. So it made for a tough combination sometimes because you weren't sure if it was warranted. It definitely wasn't. Like, we had people cheering for double faults and faults, right? Like, it wasn't totally about tennis at all. And I get that you want to see the favorite go down sometimes, but every time you watch matches like this with either the Williams sisters, it was very unsettling, I found.
Well, she's an amalgamation for a lot of things of sort of lots of different kind of emotions that she attracts. She really is a lightning rod in so many ways. And you mentioned the race factor. That's clearly a factor. It's impossible to overlook that. I think there's also an American factor here as well. I'm not entirely convinced that the French crowd, pro-Belgian crowd, is particularly fond of seeing Americans get to the latter stages of this tournament either. I don't want to speak too far out of turn, but it is also a factor in many ways around the sporting world.
When I visited Roland Garros last year, I tried to get him with Marlboro cigarettes and they made me throw them out and buy a French brand. That's how I'm joking, obviously, but no, it's definitely a thing.
Are you?
No comment, but it was definitely a thing. The big American to show you what's what, and the big American to kick the living crap out of you consistently. And that's what Serena was doing to everyone. So that combination did make it a powder keg of waiting for something to hop off. But I'm so happy that not only was that atmosphere there, for better or for worse, obviously, with some people just being terrible, but not only was that atmosphere there, the play matched it. Like, these two were absolutely slugging. And I mentioned this a bit earlier, but I was watching Henin's footwork, especially in the early moments of this set, and it was impeccable. And I thought Serena played extremely well. Like, Serena was not playing poorly. It was just Henin was on a different level.
I think it's one thing to point out to anyone, and I really do recommend, like with all the matches that we watch, I recommend going back and at least checking the highlights out of them, because I think it's really fascinating to look at some of these past eras and some of these players who have been at the top of the game. Justine Henin, just the ball striking I mentioned is incredible. The mind is incredible. But just between the two of them, the level of tennis is really, really high. And I think this is probably the highest level of tennis we've spoken about in a women's match so far. I would struggle to find something that tops this in terms of two players at the absolute top of their game. I know Justine Henin hasn't won a Grand Slam at this point, and there's many questions about, you know, whether she will ever win a big one or whether she's going to be good enough to get to that, you know, over the final hump and win one here. But goodness me, like, they really do look like the two best players in the world at this point in time, watching them here.
100%. Henin led early and she rode that lead to a 5-2 lead. She broke twice and then served it out for a 6-2 early margin against Serena Williams. Massive for the nerves. You're facing the top player in the world. You're facing someone who really has not had to really fight adversity. Just for context, she absolutely thrashed Emily Maresmo in the quarterfinals, who is the fifth-ranked player at that time and who was a multiple-time Grand Slam champion. But she was easily dispatched. I think we cannot understate or overstate, sorry, how good Serena was at this moment in time in the spring of 2003. For Henin to just come out with everything she had and more in the reserve, as you would see, was very impressive. She takes the advantage in the first set. We go to the second set, maybe expecting a dip, Bush, but none of the sort. It kept going. The backhand of Serena, wow.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And I mentioned at the start of the first set, I think NN took Serena a little bit by surprise in terms of the power, in terms of the defensive ability, in terms of the movement and everything. Certainly not in the second set. The level is extraordinarily high here. They both hold serve. I think Serena works out a little bit in terms of how she can win points. And it's one of the very underrated things about Serena Williams throughout her career. And everyone just sees the power and the movement, all those sort of things. But she's an excellent problem solver as well. And she manages to dig her way out of many different holes throughout this second set, especially at the start of the second set in particular, because she's reeling a little bit, right? As much as you can be on the back of a 33 match win streak, which we always have to keep in context. But she has the crowd against her. She has an opponent playing extraordinarily well on her favorite surface. She's not hitting clean winners past her. NN's managed to pick the balls up from ridiculous positions. But for Serena to be able to actually problem solve in a way to win points consistently and to raise her level to a point, and it gets very, very intense through the middle part of this set.
It's intense is a fantastic word. And this match happened 17 years ago and I was getting nervy as well. There is a moment at 4-3 where Serena is fighting her way back and she is able to get the break, and it you got to listen to it. It's an incredible reaction. Simon, that yell, that scream says it all.
Yeah, and the fact you can hear it across the crowd as well is quite something, right?
The sort of different. I wanted to use the French clip for this source as well, because you could hear the announcers are like, "Oh yeah, all right, here we go." And it was good for many reasons, but I love that Hannon just broke back right away. Like, she wasn't going to go calmly.
I mentioned the level in this second setup. It's so good. It's so high, and the fact that she manages to break back immediately following that scream, following just the outpouring of emotion to get that break of serve, for Serena to hang on in there, to raise her level, get the break, all the momentum goes with her, and then NN breaks back immediately. Such grit, such determination. And there is a look that Serena gives across the net. And I don't know the relationship between these two. I saw it was very cordial when they played each other in 2010 in France, following some of the antics that happened here in 2003, and it looked a lot friendlier. And I think they probably have patched things up in a lot of ways, but there wasn't a lot of love lost in this match, was there? There was a few long stares. There was a few sort of sideways looks at the box, and there's a big, big look across the net that Serena gives, which NN matches in the third set, which is very entertaining.
I mean, this is why they're not friends, or were not friends, right? is this not why this match at the time? You're right that I read an interview Hannon did many years later where she regrets what happened later, but I don't think they had a huge relationship. And if anything, this was definitely not helping things as the match went on and the antagonism grew. But Serena again showing resolve. You know, Hannon gets back. She's back on serve, but here comes Serena again, who manages to use the backhand to work into places that, you know, she's hitting millimeter placement of lines and corners and challenging Hannon's fantastic backhand herself. And Serena was winning those battles at the end of the second set, enough so to force it to a third and deciding set. And again, I we talk about the level being consistently good, and it's not hyperbole to say that the third set was arguably the best that we had amongst so many good rallies and action throughout this match. Simon, I thought the third set lived up to the hype and then some.
And I don't think this match gets talked about in the tennis circles, but it gets talked about for the wrong reasons, I think. I think the hand and all the things that happen in the third set and the drama and all the sort of things that we like to talk about from a, you know, somewhat childish perspective of this whole thing, from a storyline perspective, just the level of tennis is absolutely incredible. It really, really is. And I really would like to just put on record here, as much as you can do from sitting in your living room and chatting about tennis, this match is amazing. Just the overall quality is absolutely superb from both of them.
Serena breaks her 3-1 after some brutally long rallies. You know, there's attrition. There's like not having a great time watching some maybe mundane rallies, but I thought these are terrific. I feel like when you watch Hannon's backhand and you watch some of the angles he take, it's instructive to see where her feet are again, because it's wild. It's absolutely incredible balance. It's like incredible core strength, and she's out hitting Serena at points here, but Williams is able to take an early lead. It's game of cat and mouse, pardon the cliche, but then here comes Henin again, and throughout this match, you've seen Henin respond to some pretty bad moments, and she did it right there, but here comes Serena, and that leads us to the big moment of the match. It's why it's called the hand match. Simon, I'll let you intro us into the scene at 4-2.
Well, this one, it looks so stupid looking back on it. And I think that's the one thing that struck me about watching this one back, is that this is all a bit of nothing. Genuinely, I really think it is. And I know all the things that go into it, because there's so much emotion at the point of the time. The crowd is really, really loud. It's a very pro-Belgian crowd. Both badly want to win. It's deadlocked almost in a certain way. Henin's doing anything she can do to get back and win this match.
You've got the crowd making in and out calls consistently now. Like it is anarchy, you could argue, on the court.
And I think for the most part, most of the line calls are pretty correct. I think everyone who is doing their job is getting it correct. Serena marks a ball at 15 love. She sees one of Henin's balls long, which it is. She circles it correctly, and the crowd just lets her have it. And we are fully at like Roman gladiatorial theater levels at this. Yeah. It's anything that's happening. This is proper like thumbs down to the emperor levels of disrespect going on in this crowd.
It's quite the scene, and we'll play it out for you right now.
He's the one who called it long in the first place.
Justine's not trusting Serena's call right now.
You think he's going to say it's good?
He would if it was.
Shot spot. He's back.
Once again, Serena's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And the fans now are kind of turning on Serena for questioning the calls, but she's been right both times. And these fans they're not right to do that. 30 love.
That's ugly. It's been out of character what's going on the entire tournament here, but the sheer of fault.
Serena wants a first serve because of that. I don't think she'll get it. She had her hand up, Serena saying about Justine, so she wants two serves. Justine had put her hand up. Now where is saying I didn't see that. Yeah. Justine, that's Serena's after once
right
again
on. Serena's right.
You can hear it, Simon, the energy and the charge, and we've heard cheers for double false and false before, and pretty bad moments where the crowd has not painted themselves in a good light, but this was something else. This the sound, the derision, we had it all.
And I think so much of this, we want to say like one person was correct, one person was in the wrong, someone was doing something outright, you know, worse than the other person. Honestly, I think they're both out of order in a little bit of ways here. Like, you kind of want them both just to act a little better. But really, like, in the grand scheme of things, I can kind of understand how this happened, right? I can kind of understand that, you know, Henin badly wants to win. She kind of, you know, you don't like it, but you see it all the time. You see it all the time where people try and work at the margins of things. Yeah, the umpire is supposed to do the job, but whatever, you know, you can play within the spirit of it. Serena rightly gets a bit annoyed by the whole thing. The reaction at the end's a bit dodgy and a bit weird, but then again, she's being berated by 18,000 angry Parisians, and she feels like the whole world's against her. And she's just lost after the first time in 33 matches at a Grand Slam. You can kind of understand why both players end up at the scenario they do.
So Serena's perturbed because Ashi's about to deliver a first serve. Henin puts her hand up, trying to get her to delay until the crowd quiets down. Umpire doesn't see it. Seemingly, Serena sees it the last minute, but she dumps the serve. So the umpire did not see Henin put her hand up. And when she asked, or when he asked Henin whether she did it or not, she was unwilling to admit it, which made Serena extremely mad. She ends up losing the next point and getting broken. Every miss she made was getting booed and cheered mockingly by the crowd. It was a whole lot of something. And I think you're right, Simon. I think you can see it in both ways. You can see it where Henin's like, all right, she didn't care if I put my hand up, if that serve goes in, right? Like if I get the point there, if Serena gets the point, mm-hmm. she's not going to be like, oh, maybe she wasn't ready. That's probably not the reaction. Whereas, I mean, Henin, Serena's like, listen, like, you know, it's loud. They're all cheering for you. If anything, like, you should own the fact that you were waiting or wanting time to be called, and you did it. You lied. So I definitely see where both are coming from. But the crowd being so anti-Serena definitely made it seem like someone had committed murder, and I didn't think it was Serena.
You know, I'm trying so hard to think of I have a perfect metaphor in my head, but I don't want to say it because it's going to come across really weird. Okay, I'm just going to throw this out there. And in no capacity does the phrase that I use and how I'm describing this illustrate any kind of feelings in one way. You know, in football, right? Yeah. Where you have a bit of pushing and shoving, you have a bit of like yelling at each other. Everyone's coming around the referee. It's all a bit heated. And then the referee just like, all right, lads, let's just calm down a bit. Okay. Everyone just take a second. It's all just a bit of like showboating, a bit of like pushing, a bit of bravado, and then cooler heads prevail and everyone backs away. You kind of feel like just for a second, they could have just done with just a minute or so just to grab a breather. Because if you look at it, and I know in the heat of battle, you're like, well, this is the most important thing in the world. But really, Serena's up 30 love. All she has to do is close this one out and she's a game away from winning another Grand Slam or getting close to winning a Grand Slam. She doesn't have to lose 4 points in a row, right? Like, and it's the other side of things as well. You always look at it, it's like, oh, this 1 point decided an entire match. And I'm sure it did in some ways. Like, I'm sure psychologically this got into her head as well, but you're up 30 love. It's the worst thing. It's just a point. Move on from it. And easier said than done. So much easier said than done. But it kind of feels that way. It gets blown up way bigger than this has to be over something that's really stupid.
It is something when you consider this happened in 2003 and then look forward to maybe similar incidents. It's worth noting. I thought the umpire, Jorge Diaz, did not do a good job. I think this is a problem for tennis umpires in general. It is very hard to really pick out on like five moments where I thought the umpire did a great job handling one of these situations where the players are entitled and it's a solo sport and it completely jacks their mind or warps their mind in terms of what is acceptable and what is not. And I get that. It's a hard job as an umpire, but really outside of calling things in or out, this is part of your mandate as the umpire. And I thought he did a terrible job handling this, but it wasn't his job to put Serena back together again after this. And you said it, Bush, she's up 4-2, 30 love. She should finish this. And Justine Henin, again, throughout this match, we've seen her basically come up with something that no one had against Serena during this time. And it was enough to really push her all the way back. 4-2 up, Serena is now lock level with Henin, and the match is completely sideways from just 30 minutes beforehand.
Really, really bizarre unraveling in that game alone. And I get it. Like, it can cause so many problems just mentally. You go on a bit of a walkabout for a few moments in time and you lose a game. We've all been there. We all understand how it feels. But I'm really surprised at what happens after this. I think the level stays really high. I think Serena uses it really well, actually. And it's not like she just capitulated and everything fell apart. I think in that one game, she kind of did and it rattled her. But Henin played really well. And I think that's the thing that we all remember this moment as that flashbulb moment, that point in the match. And it's like, okay, because of that, she lost. Really, Henin played really well, honestly. Serena didn't go away without fighting at all. She played some of her best tennis in the next few games afterwards. She hit some outrageous winners. And Henin raised the game as well. So the end of this is really, really good.
I think it's interesting all these years later, when Justine Henin talks about this match or her rivalry with Serena or where maybe she stood overall in tennis when you talk about Kim Clijsters as well. And it seemed like respect was a big thing for her and maybe not getting as much as she thought she deserved. And you know, it's hard to agree sometimes because I feel like at the time, maybe she was appreciated, but as years have drawn on, you don't really hear a discussion involving Justine Henin when we talk about some of the greatest women's players of all time. But I think you have to put her on a certain level amongst the all-time greats, because she really was mentally strong as well with a game to match. She does take that game. She's able to then take the match. It's a stunner. Justine Henin comes back in the third set to defeat Serena Williams 6-2, 4-6, 7-5. Books a date with Kim Clijsters in the final, who she absolutely demolishes for her first Grand Slam. It's Justine Henin's time. I thought this quote, Bush, very interesting. Justine Henin says after the match, "Serena saw me and she served. It was her decision to serve. I just tried to stay focused on the second serve. It's very important to concentrate on the positive things from the match and try to forget this kind of incident." Serena, for her part, said, quote, "I was a little disappointed with her. I probably still should have won the game. It definitely didn't turn around the match. But I think to start lying and fabricating, it's not fair. It's just a tough crowd out there today. Really very tough. Story of my life." You know, it's an amazing quote because the latter part, 100%. But that bit of the lying and fabricating, that was the juice. That was the fork in the plug that really ignited this entire rivalry, I thought.
Yeah, I don't think either of them are right. I think it's one of those very weird scenarios where both of them kind of look bad, honestly. I think both the way they handle themselves looks a bit rubbish, to be honest.
It sort of, you know, it sort of sucks too. Like, this shouldn't be called the hand match. Like, this should be called one of the top levels from two players that we've seen in a Grand Slam with extremely high stakes. But it will never be remembered for that. And obviously there is a lot of matches to consider, but how many matches are known by like one word or like by a couple words? Like, there's very few
very
in
many,
tennis.
Right?
In tennis, for sure,
yeah.
Right? So it's a shame. I mentioned respect being a big thing for Justine Henin, but here's what she had to say some 10, 11 years later, I believe. Quote, "Maybe it was a way to give me respect because you know that Williams have an attitude, sometimes difficult. They play with a lot of intimidation, knowing that the Williams had attitudes that were sometimes difficult. Today doesn't scare me anymore. When they walked on the court, the other one was already there at their side. It was a big moment in my career, in the moment of Roland Garros too. The weak handshake, the start sort of a long story between us, but I think we kept mutual respect. Not one of the warmest moments in the history of tennis, but still remains a great memory." She's talking about a lot of stuff there, but the intimidation factor, like, it was a thing on tour. People saw Serena and Venus and were like, "We're going to lose." That was a thing that was felt when they were walking away with title after title. But the handshake thing, like, Serena didn't shake anyone's hand after the match was done. And that was the other big part of this match, where Serena was, like, indicted by the mass media and sports journalists about being a poor loser. And I mean, when you win all the time and your first loss and you don't shake anyone's hand and they call the other one a liar and a fabricator, it does not win you hearts and minds, probably. But I definitely understand where she's coming from. It was off. She put her hand up. Like, I find it hard to find extreme fault.
It's a really challenging one, isn't it? The layers that are in there in terms of some of the coded language, perhaps, in terms of how deep you want to dig in all
time.
Of this stuff.
Big time.
I think the word attitude gets associated with many things. All of them, or some of them, sorry, not great, especially when it comes in the perspective that it is. But it's undoubtedly true that the Williams sisters held themselves in a certain way on tour at that period of time, and there was an intimidation factor. Now, quite what the other factors that are involved in there that we would dig into further if we had another hour and a half.
The code talking is so over the top and like in your face that is what bothers me. You said it exactly right, Bush. In this quote, but attitude is there three times.
And I know that is true. And I think this is a really, really challenging one because I do not. How do you phrase this without coming across as a Serena hater? Because I do think there is a certain way. And I think this actually stretches to a wider point as well about an sort of an American sort of attitude, perhaps.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, and
like
I think
the
that's
sort of
fair.
The Sophia Kennan sort of thing. Like, it's, you know, it's very brash. It's very outspoken. And there is not a race factor in the way that Kennan holds herself. And I think this is, you know, we talked about when Kennan played Serena Australia, right? The fact that it's looking in a mirror in terms of how they hold each other on court in a lot of ways. Because I do think there is something truth to that. And I do think there's some truth in the way that Bianca Andreescu holds herself on tour. as well, and on court as well, where it is like no backward step. It is in your face attitude, you know, itchy, scratchy and poochy from The Simpsons. It is all of those sort of things. And there is that fine line where it is hard to discuss this stuff without slipping into sort of race baiting at a certain point, because I do think that Serena had a certain amount of bullying about her at that point in time, in both a positive and negative way.
Yeah, I think the pure fact that the Williams sisters scared the shit out of the tennis establishment and a lot of people who covered the game who were not prepared for this at all. And yep. And what happened was you had a lot of people talking out of the just nonsense and poorly trying to manufacture an argument that they thought possibly was enlightened and not racist, but just came out wrong. And that happened so many times, especially in the late 90s, early aughts Bush, where like it was ridiculous. And I can only imagine, like, mm-hmm. incredibly tough for the Williams sisters to deal with, but it was forever. And like, I was thinking about what happened with Osaka at that final and like that, what it all means together and whether you can draw some sort of connection. But I think Serena, rightfully so, has not felt like she's been given the benefit of the doubt enough times in her career as someone who has literally won everything and like done everything well and done things that nobody ever thought was possible before. I think she feels like she is not given the benefit of the doubt that others get. And it's really hard to argue against that. To say she was right in the Osaka affair, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that you could see it from all the way back in 2003, where it was coming from, because the tennis establishment did not do themselves any favors and came across just terrible at times.
I don't disagree with you at all. I think the amount of just guff that she's taken through her career, that both of them have, that Venus has taken as well, has been pretty ridiculous, really, if you see some of the corners of the media. Now, having said that, all that, I don't think she's not without fault. And I think sometimes wider media in some ways, given how much oftentimes rubbish she gets thrown her way, I think sometimes it is fair to be critical of someone. I think there are moments throughout her career where honestly she didn't act great. And I think this is one of those moments where she didn't act great. And I think Anna didn't act great either. And I think that's probably a fair place to leave this overall like discussion of what this particular moment meant. It was two very young women, both very, very competitive in a very feisty atmosphere with a crowd that was very pro one side. It's going to lead to some weird stuff. Honestly, that's what's going to happen, right? And it's just the nature of it where this tiny thing where honestly, like in the grand scheme of things, I've played in club matches where someone's done that and you're like, come on, dude. And he's like, nope, I didn't do anything. Or you're trying to serve in mixed doubles and someone's like, oh, I wasn't ready, as you serve a clean ace past them. It's like, well, you probably were, right?
Shouts to this gold prospector who was playing at your club based on the accent. Did he just come back from the Yukon? It's well said. We'll get to the aftermath of what happened after this, right after the break. Welcome back. The final segment of this Open Era Rewind, Serena Williams, Justine Henin, 2003 French Open. We mentioned the other side of the bracket, Monica Seles' last Grand Slam, and she was beaten by Nadia Petrova, who made it all the way to the semis before Kim Clijsters ended that run. Simon, Justine Henin carried over how well she was playing against Serena, except there was no pushback from the other side this time. There was no Serena. Kim got just dummied.
Yep. Absolutely annihilated. And it happens to quite a lot of players throughout Justin Henin's career on clay as well. There are a lot of proverbial S kickings throughout her career. So not beyond the realm of possibility that would happen in a final either.
Some quotes. I'm very happy. It's an emotional moment. I have to get my energy back for Saturday. That's Henin. It was a wonderful atmosphere. There were so many Belgians here and the French fans were behind me too. They definitely were. The Belgian and the Americans split their 8 matches at majors 4-4. The next time Serena would win this title would be 10 years later in 2013 when she beat Maria Sharapova. I think just to pick something out, Bush, here is Justine Henin saying, at 4-2 down in the third, I had some doubts, but it's so good to be into my first final here. And then the other quote, but I believed in myself, took it point by point as I kept my focus. Serena can be very intimidating. It was tough to serve out. Like, all of the stuff that came out of this match, both at the time right after and many years later, possibly hold up. Not everything, but most of it. Like, they respected each other to a point. They became good friends or better friends later. But at this time, I don't think it was a super harmonious atmosphere. And it doesn't have to be. Like, I don't have anything wrong with two people not liking each other playing against each other. It makes for some extremely good stuff to watch. But I overall made it felt uneasy at times, Simon, watching this. And I think it goes back to the history of everything and the history of what the Williams sisters faced. We talked about what happened to them in Indian Wells, and it was hard not to think about that as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think looking at one of the other factors I didn't get talked about in some ways is, given that Serena Williams' career has been so amazing and just so impeccable in certain ways throughout her performances on court, her record of the French Open by all-time great levels is not the best. She has had her hit success ratio is not the best. I mean, she's won three times in France, which is astonishing. Like, anyone would be happy to win three Grand Slam titles. But when you're talking about all-time greats, she doesn't have the best record there. It's by far her worst surface. It's by far her worst tournament in terms of the other three Grand Slams. She's won 65 matches there and had 13 losses. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? And she doesn't really recover from this one for a while. You mentioned she doesn't win for 10 years. In Paris, she gets to the quarterfinal the next year, and then really, it's a pretty long barren run. She loses in the first round in 2012. It's interesting, isn't it? We always think about her as such just an all surface player, but there's a long period of time where she does nothing on a clay court.
Rossano took her out in the first round in 2012. Like, she's had some shockers at the French Open. All to make up for a paltry 83% winning percentage. Just terrible. 65 and 13 all time, Simon. That's trash. It's just terrible.
Not good enough, right? Yeah, trash.
Serena does well at Wimbledon, where she beats Venus in three sets and then goes on to... I mean, Henin was there. Henin, we mentioned her biggest rivals and Davenport and her sister and Maria Sharapova. She has that loss to Maria, the famous loss in 2004, changing of the guard that really meant nothing. In the grand scheme of things, no guard was changed. Davenport hanging around there, Jelena Jankovic. It has really screwed up all my conversations about depth and what eras are better. All these look back, Simon, because I think I'm now pretty firm in what I believe, and it's that talking like 98 to 2004 or 5 is the golden age of women's tennis.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I mentioned off the start that I think we were robbed of an all-time great rivalry. And I really do believe that. I've said on another podcast that I think you put Justine Henin in a body that doesn't break down and give her a few inches in height and a few more pounds in muscle, just an overall like stronger, more athletic body. It's not to discount the fact that she's still amazing given what she was born with. And I think she's winning 20 Grand Slams. I really genuinely believe that, just given the talent level. It's a shame. It's such a shame because I really would have liked to see more of this. They play each other another few times, but their Grand Slam record, every single one they play, is really, really good, including that one where Serena trounces her at Wimbledon. Still, the quality is very, very high. I would struggle to find a better example of someone who opens up like Henin does. She finds herself 3-love down. And honestly, the quality is so high in that match at Wimbledon. And it's crazy. Like, I think she loses 2-2 or something, 3-2. And honestly, she didn't play badly. Like, against anyone else, she would have won that match. And that's a sign of the level that they both played against each other.
Kim Clijsters won the most titles in 2003 with 9, but the player of the year was Justine Henin. Simon, anything else before we wrap up?
Yes, just one interesting piece of housekeeping. We mentioned Juan Carlos Ferrero, and I just did a quick search around him. Juan Carlos Ferrero, after winning in 2003 at the French Open, never passed the third round again for the rest of his career. That's amazing. I never realized that. I always, his God, record, 2000, God. Semifinal, 2001, semifinal, 2002 final, winner in 2003, nothing for the rest of his career. That's amazing.
Golden age of women's tennis, some fantastic stuff. Bad stuff on the ATP side, as we mentioned. No hate for JCF, Juan Carlos Ferro, and we will do a match of his for you, Simon, in the near future.
Appreciate it.
Many thanks to our producer, Dylan Wilson, as always, for his work on the ones and twos. You can find us on Twitter at OpenEraPod, at patreon.com/OpenEra. $3 a month would help us out. For Simon and myself, thanks as always for listening to Open Era. We'll talk to you next week.